Hi, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to The Record on KUOW. Seattle gets a new mayor today. Jenny Durkin will be sworn in this afternoon. Meanwhile, the outgoing mayor ended his term with a big promise.
Next year, we will move more than twice as many people from homelessness to permanent homes compared to this year. More than twice as many.
More than twice as many, and Tim Burgess said Seattle will do that by managing its homelessness budget better than it has.
Business as usual, or continuing to do the same over and over again, is no longer an option. The scale of the human crisis that we face requires us to do more, to be razor focused on successfully moving people to permanent homes.
No more business as usual when it comes to homelessness. Well, on the phone now is one of the service providers whose budget is being cut, Sharon Lee of the Low Income Housing Institute. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you so much.
And you say this act by the city is going to put more people in harm's way. Why is that?
Absolutely. We have cuts to shelter beds. We have cuts to hygiene, meeting basic human needs such as showers, laundry, restrooms. We also have transitional housing that helps immigrant refugees and people with mental illness and victims of domestic violence stabilize in housing and then move on to permanent housing. So there's a host of problems with the recommendations. I find it awfully strange that Tim Burgess, on his pretty much last day of office, announced major cuts when there's an incoming new mayor, and we also have a city council that is that cares a great deal around ending homelessness.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment. I want to know how this move by the city, how you think it will affect people who you serve at Low Income Housing Institute. Can you think of a specific client you know and tell me how this affects someone's life in your opinion?
Well, the urban rest stop in the U District offers free showers, laundry, and restroom use to about 1,700 people a year, including young adults, seniors, veterans. And the city Human Service Department totally zeroed out all funding, which means that place will have to close. We do not know of another large-scale or, accessible hygiene facility in the U District. So that means the homeless people, including, we have homeless students, we have, homeless families. Where are they going to go and use the bathroom? How are the merchants going to be affected, the businesses? They can no longer say, oh, if you're not using, you can't use our restroom, or if you're not shopping in our store, why don't you go down the street and go down to the urban rest stop? And then the cuts were also made to the downtown urban rest stop. The downtown urban rest stop, I was there yesterday, it's packed full of people doing something very, very innocent. Washing their clothes, taking a shower, trying to get ready for work, applying for housing. And the cuts were so deep at the downtown rest stop, we'll have to shut down on weekends. We're the only place that opens for people to use facilities on the weekends. And we'll have to probably shut down evening hours for homeless people who are working and struggling and people who are living on the streets. They can't come in and in the evening wash their clothes, take a shower, and get ready for the next day.
Okay, again, this is Sharon Lee from the Low Income Housing Institute. Also with us now, one of the people at the City of Seattle who decides how to spend money on homelessness, Jason Johnson, Deputy Director of Seattle's Human Services. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You just heard Sharon Lee talk about the downside of closing, in this case, a hygiene facility, showers. She talked about fewer shelters available. What is the city thinking?
So the city's, through this RFP that was announced, that awards were announced yesterday, we are investing $34 million across 30 agencies to help fund 98 high-performing projects. The urban rest stop that Sharon mentioned is one of those projects. The city has a $540,000 investment in the urban rest stops through Lehigh. But those $34 million that we've invested, as Mayor mentioned yesterday, is going to more than double the number of households exited from the streets and from transitional programming into permanent housing.
That is key to the city's plan to move far more people into permanent housing. Will you explain how the city plans to do that?
Sure. One way is a complete transformation of the shelter system. So we are no longer going to have a shelter system that is a basic overnight roof overhead mat on floor shelter. Instead, we will have much more enhanced shelter beds that totaling up to will be funding, 1,244 enhanced beds through this RFP.
What is an enhanced bed?
Enhanced bed is a bed that is low barrier. It has services attached. It has a very intentional service to get people through that shelter quickly and into permanent housing. Oftentimes, the shelter operates 24/7, and those enhanced shelters often come with hygiene services like toilets, like laundry, like washrooms, and areas to store belongings.
Sharon Lee, are you one of the things your group does is operate shelters. Are you operating mat-on-the-floor type shelters that don't lead to permanent housing?
We have a shelter in Belltown, and we have people who come here. It's a share shelter, and people spend the night. And we connect them with social workers to try to get them into housing. Now, one of the major cuts that's being made is that the number of actual shelter beds are being decreased by 250 to 300 beds at a time where we have close to 4,000 unsheltered homeless people on the streets. So a total net reduction of shelter beds is devastating. I'll give you an example. We have 12 churches that have opened up their parish hall, their basement, their unused space, and the churches have been great partners with the community, saying part of our mission is to help homeless people. And that program with SHARE and the churches has been effectively terminated and zeroed out.
Well, let's ask Jason Johnson about that with the city. Jason, is that true? The number of shelter beds is being reduced by the city, 250 to 300 fewer beds?
That is true. There will be a reduction of overnight-only shelter beds made in 2018. That said, we are really making an investment in quality over quantity. We believe that the 24/7 enhanced shelters that we are investing in will be able to much more quickly and much more effectively get people not only through those programs, but through those programs and into a permanent end to their homeless experience, meaning get them into permanent housing. Enhanced models help people stabilize, and therefore they can focus on navigating to housing rather than the daily survival skills.
Well, Sharon, I have heard that there are many shelter beds that go unused because they're too high barrier, rules and restrictions, and that. So could it be that the shelters Jason's talking about are shelters that are going to work more for the people who agree to go into them?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why there are some vacancies. Part of the reason why we've seen vacancies is because the city and King County set up a coordinated entry system, which is like a big waiting list, and therefore you had to take people from the waiting list. And the waiting list referral only happens during daytime hours, Monday through Friday, right? And the shelters have vacancies in the evenings and weekends, and then those beds don't get referred. It's a very common sense solution, which is when there's a vacancy, send someone who's homeless, and it will be filled.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. The tiny house villages. The tiny house villages are full, and we take people at any time of day. And lots of people spend their whole day looking for a place, and only at the end of the day, at nighttime, do they find themselves, especially families with children, they find themselves stranded. Well, that's where you have to have availability and a process for making sure that all the beds are filled. That is not a difficult situation.
This is Sharon Lee from the Low Income Housing Institute, along with Jason Johnson with the city, the deputy director of the city's Human Services Department. We're talking about the changes the city's making to try to double the number of people who leave homelessness next year compared to this year. And a big part of this that we've only touched on is the idea that the city would move to more of a permanent housing model. They call it rapid rehousing. Get people rent subsidies and get them into their own place and de-emphasize transitional housing. Jason, will you explain why you think that's a better way to go?
Sure. Our focus is on permanent housing. Our focus is we are laser focused on making sure that we are ending people's experience of homelessness, not just managing it. HSD is funding a continuum of response options to meet individual needs. So you mentioned rapid rehousing. That's one tool. But we're also increasing our investments in prevention, in diversion, in permanent supportive housing, as well as in outreach programs that have flexible dollars aimed at getting people directly from a situation where they're living on the streets, living unsheltered tonight, into a permanent housing option. So rapid rehousing is one tool that providers have, but we're increasing our funding in all permanent housing options that people can access.
Okay, and there are so many different types of programs to try to keep track of. I want to focus just for a moment on rapid rehousing. These involve rent subsidies, but the rent subsidies are not permanent, right, Jason? What happens when you help someone into housing and then over time those subsidies run out?
Yeah, so rapid rehousing, as you described, is a short-term rent subsidy. It's a rent subsidy that can be used in the private market. And I think when we talk about rapid rehousing, often we're talking about those vouchers. I think less often we're talking about the services that are attached to that voucher. Rapid rehousing is both cash assistance as well as a level of support that not only helps the individual find housing that should be and should continue to be affordable to them once the subsidy runs out, but it also is a level of service that can be that the person can access even after the housing voucher ends. So rapid rehousing is both a short-term housing subsidy and a level of support that individuals and families can access.
Okay, Sharon Lee, it's rent subsidies, but also these support services. Why are you so skeptical of the city's emphasis now on, among other things, rapid rehousing to be a permanent solution?
Well, I think the city hired two national consultants who came to town and said that rapid rehousing was a national best practice, and they refused to look at the local market. Of course, you can find apartments in New Orleans and Salt Lake City for $700 a month, and you can cobble together maybe a couple of minimum wage jobs and pay that rent. You cannot do that in Seattle. You cannot have market rents at $1,500 to $2,600, let's say, for a family, right? And expect that if you have a minimum wage job of $15 an hour, that you can sustain that rent after the subsidy is withdrawn.
Well, what about moving people to a cheaper suburb along a bus line or a light rail line if they need that?
We think that a lot of housing by light rail, those are the areas that you're seeing more and more market rate housing, and you're seeing more and more displacement. And those are unlikely to be the places where low-income people can go.
Jason,
Well, we had an example of San Francisco saying that in order for families to use rapid rehousing, they had to move 60 miles outside of San Francisco. I think we have high housing costs just like San Francisco, and people who are very vulnerable are going to have to move far away to, secure housing, and then they may still lose their housing.
Jason?
So rapid rehousing, you could be housed, right, and then lose your housing in 3 months or 6 months.
Jason, what do you say? Where would you be sending people, and then what's your argument for that?
So national data as well as local data shows that rapid rehousing programs are successful. They're successful in that they quickly get people into a stable home. They help them for a short period of time pay the costs of that housing. They provide a level of support services while the person is transitioning into that housing, and that people are staying housed. I would say that we look at we looked at models across the country as well. We looked at San Francisco, Los Angeles, cities that have a similar high rent rental market, similar to Seattle. I would say that as it relates to people finding housing in other communities, there are two things I would offer. One is that I believe someone having housing is better than someone not having housing. I think that if we are working to get someone indoors to a place that is stable and a place that they don't have to leave after a certain time, that that is a very good thing. And I also believe that we have to offer some level of choice. There are people who are accessing services in Seattle because there are a lot of those services here, but ultimately Rapid Rehousing allows them to choose which market rate unit they would like them and their children to live in.
Okay, Jason, finally, because our time is up here, is there any issue of the city planning for homes and help in the future, but cutting off short-term help for people? Here it is with winter coming. Is that happening as part of the city's shift or not?
Yeah, so the shift is, as I mentioned, to 24/7 enhanced shelter emergency services, as well as a focus on investing in permanent housing options for individuals and families. We realize that any time we make a shift in investment, there is some work that we need to do to help with the change. And we've identified bridge funding to allow any of the impacted shelter services, as well as some of the day or hygiene services that we're funding, a period of ramp down. We've identified some bridge funding, and so we have made it possible that none of the beds will be impacted this winter, and in most cases, we'll have a period of 6 months to help organizations transition.
Okay, that's our time for this for now. We will winter is on the way, and we'll watch how the city's new spending priorities and the people it's trying to help, how all of this works out over the first year of Mayor Jenny Durkan's term. I've been talking with Sharon Lee of the Low Income Housing Institute and Jason Johnson, Deputy Director, Seattle's Human Services. We'll follow this together. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle with more coming up. Stay tuned. World-renowned writer Isabel Allende has authored 23 books. 23. That work ethic, it's one of many things her grandpa drilled into her.
Don't complain. Don't expect any help. Serve. Be responsible. Be honest. Don't whine. No time to look at yourself in the mirror. No time to be looking at your navel. No introspection. Just be out there in the world and work. That was the lesson. And it served me well. But now I'm 75 years old and I want to relax and have some fun, for God's sake.
If you're a fan of Allende's writing, you'll be glad to know fun does not mean she has stopped writing. She's in Seattle today to talk about her latest novel. Even though Seattle has let her down before, she still remembers coming back to Seattle specifically to buy a dress she had seen here in a window downtown.
It was a Lulu Lang dress that looked like a butterfly. And I came back to Seattle, took a plane, and came back to try the dress. I looked terrible. I looked like an extra in the Cirque du Soleil.
So the dress was a work of art, but maybe not a garment for you at this time.
Few garments are for me. I can only buy off the rack a Snoopy pajama, probably. The rest needs to be adjusted.
I see. Well, I'm so glad you're here doing a public radio interview. However, I understand that romantic and strange things can happen when you do public radio interviews.
I know.
Yeah. Would you tell that story?
Well, I had... First of all, let me refer a little bit to the book.
Yes.
That is called In the Midst of Winter. And it refers to those emotional winters that we all go through in our lives sooner or later. And at the time when I started writing this book, I had been going through one of those long emotional winters because I had divorced my husband after 28 years of marriage, and I had loved that man very much. My beloved agent, Carmen Balcells, died suddenly. Three of my best friends died, and my dog Olivia died. So it was a time of sorrow somehow. And then I started writing this book, and as it usually happens, the book pulled me out of whatever depressive mood I was in because I was so interested in the story. And I started the book on January 8th.
As always.
As always, last year. And then around May, I got an email in my office from a guy who had heard me on NPR, a widower from New York who was driving to Boston, and he pulled over because he heard me on the radio. And he didn't like what I said. I have no idea what I said. And so he emailed the office. And we started corresponding. I would answer sometimes, but he emailed me every morning and every evening for 5 months. I mean, the patience of this guy and how stubborn he is. Uh-huh. And so eventually we met in New York in October because I had to go to a gala of the Center for Reproductive Rights. And so I invited him to the gala. We met there among many, many other people. And the next day we went out for lunch. And in the main course was ravioli. And I thought, what am I doing here? So I said, look, what are your intentions? Because I'm 75 years old, I have no time to waste. If somebody says that to me, I would have run away. Mm-hmm. But he choked on the ravioli, that's true. But he survived. And now he's moving to my house in a few weeks. He sold his house, he got rid of everything he owns, and he's coming with a bike and his clothes to live with me in a very small cottage where I live.
And it all started from him emailing you to tell you something he didn't like that you had said.
In NPR, yes.
Wow. Miracles occur. Well, who knows what will happen after this public radio interview. Talking about your novel, Isabel, you once said that you don't know what your book is about until you read the reviews.
Yeah.
And I took that as a joke, but then I wasn't so sure. Half-joking?
Half-joking, because I think I'm writing about something, and then in the review, or because somebody gives me an insight or a feedback, I realize that the book taps into something that was important for me all my life, and I hadn't sort of put it in words. And then let me give you an example. When I wrote Island Beneath the Sea, that's a book about the slave revolt in Haiti 200 years ago. Culturally, it has nothing to do with me. We never had plantations in Chile. We never had African slaves. Why would I spend 4 years of my life researching this very difficult book? And I was obsessed with it until I wrote it, never knowing why, until when the book was done, I realized that the theme of the book is absolute power with impunity, which is the power of the master over the slave. That's the worst example of it. But we have power with impunity everywhere. We are seeing it today in politics everywhere. And that has been an obsession even before the military coup for me, because I grew up in the 40s in a patriarchal, conservative, authoritarian family where authority was never questioned, and it had it was not accountable.
In your own family,
and in the society where I lived.
Mm-hmm. Well, has that happened with this book? In the midst of winter, have you learned anything about what your book is about?
Yeah, I remembered what I knew. I have been in other winters in my life, and some of them have been much deeper and longer than this one, the latest one. For example, the winter of my daughter's demise.
Paola.
And I had forgotten that there is always an invincible summer waiting to manifest itself if we give it a chance. No winter lasts forever. And so often nowadays when people seem so depressed because of politics and how divisive the country is and how gloomy everything looks, I always remind people there is an invincible summer. The summer is waiting under the surface. These are bad times, but they're not. They will not be forever. We went through 17 years of dictatorship in Chile where everything was controlled and repressed. There were no political parties allowed. And still, we got democracy back in a democratic process. So I believe that I'm optimistic without being Pollyanna. I really know that there is, that we evolve. Things get better. They don't get worse.
And Chile figures into this novel. For those of our listeners who don't know, would you remind them that your first cousin, once removed, was the president, the democratically elected president of Chile, who was deposed in part by the CIA. Would you mind telling us again what you remember about that day and those events?
Well, Salvador Allende had represented a coalition of parties of the left and the center called the Unidad Popular. And he was elected in 1970. Immediately, the forces of the conservative forces in Chile, and with the help of the CIA, tried to block whatever he tried to do in his government. For 3 years, we had a very, very bad political, economic, and social crisis. In March of 1973, we had parliamentary elections, and the Unidad Popular increased its votes in spite of the crisis. So then the CIA and the military, the CIA and the right-wing parties decided that they had to, that there were no, sabotaging the government would not end the government. They needed something drastic. And so they provoked a military coup with the idea that the military will depose Allende and then call elections. That didn't happen. Allende died during the coup, and a brutal dictatorship began with horrible repression and atrocities that were committed by the military.
The Pinochet.
The Pinochet regime that lasted 17 years. And many Chileans left the country. I was among them with my family. And others were arrested and disappeared, and their bodies were never found. Others were tortured. Many were executed without trial. There was no habeas corpus. You could be arrested and you couldn't even ask what had happened to the person. So in this book, I have three characters only, three of them traumatized, three of them living in a winter of their lives. One of them is Lucia Maraz, who is a journalist and a writer. She looks like me, but it's not me. It's a friend of mine.
And she looks like you?
In the sense that her life resembles mine, but that's because many lives of that time in Chile resemble mine. I was no exception. And so her brother disappears. She has to go into exile. She lives abroad, comes back, researches about the human rights abuses of the dictatorship, and writes two books. The second character is Richard Baumeister, who is a professor at NYU. And he teaches Latin American studies. And so he has invited Lucia to teach for a semester or two semesters. And the third character, and he also has been traumatized in his past, and we don't know until the end of the book what happened to him. And then the third character is a young woman from Guatemala, undocumented immigrant, who lives and works, almost slave work, in a household where she's the maid and she takes care of a kid. An event brings these three people together in the midst of a blizzard. So it's a real winter also. It's the winter of New York, January last year, and which I was there, so I really loved it when it happened.
And it was super warm, and then it turned.
And then it turned
to
this blizzard, epic storm that paralyzed the state, really. So that was the glue I needed to put together all these characters and this event. And so that's what the book is about. And each one of them, of course, I didn't have to research for Lucia because I know the story very well, the story of Chile. But I did research a lot for Evelyn Ortega, the Guatemalan girl. Not only I had been in Guatemala, but I have a foundation that works with refugees and immigrants. So I have cases like the case of Evelyn Ortega. I didn't have to make it up. But I did have to research the gangs in Guatemala, the political corruption and all that.
Evelyn, among other things, has fled sexual violence. Why do you, and you said you've known many women like Evelyn.
Yeah.
And I don't know everything that you mean by that, but I wonder if why do you think it is that sexual violence isn't something we talk more about when we talk about immigration, because it's an aspect that you seem to care a lot about.
Yeah, but because it's just part of the violence. It's almost taken for granted. In the case of Evelyn, her family, her two brothers are assassinated by the gang, by the MS-13, the worst gang in Central America and Mexico.
Which started in the USA.
Yeah, in LA. Mm-hmm. And it was exported back to Central America and Mexico. And it has 80,000 members, recognized members, and it's the most brutal organization, one of the most brutal in the world. And so they assassinate the brothers and they take revenge on the family. And so she's beaten up and raped as part of the process. It's not unusual that she would be raped. The only unusual thing is that she survives. And then she has to get out because she's a witness to what has happened. She needs to get out. And this is a young woman with no resources, with no family. Her mother has been sending money from the north, from the United States, for years. She doesn't even know her mother. So she travels to the United States. Now, all the traveling, the trip, the journey from Central America to the United States across Mexico is an ordeal, especially for women, because the smugglers are criminals, most of them. And they end up not only raping them, but sometimes abandoning them or selling them into prostitution, selling them to the gangs. So for women, it's really hard. And I've seen this. So to have Evelyn being the victim of sexual violence is not at all unusual. The unusual thing would have been if it didn't happen to her.
Yeah, and yet that's why I asked about it. Yet it's not something that gets talked about so much, even though we talk about immigration constantly.
And we don't talk about domestic violence. Women who come here seeking asylum because they're running away from domestic violence. One of the cases that my foundation saw, the husband and his brother, who systematically raped this woman, broke both her legs with a baseball bat. And this woman practically crawled through the border to the United States looking for asylum. But domestic violence is not considered, usually not considered, like a reason to grant asylum. No, the situation is really hard.
This is fiction. And by the way, my guest is Isabel Allende. The novel is In the Midst of Winter, and it's a fiction. And we're talking about politics. Is that what you want to happen in your reader?
No, I want to tell a story that matters to me. I want to have characters that speak for me. I couldn't possibly write a book about Wall Street, but I can write about this because I care for this and I know it. But this is not a book about politics only. There are politics. Immigration is a big theme in the book, but it's also a love story between two people who are in their 60s. So it's mature love, which I care for at this time in my life. And it's about relationships. It's about loyalty, solidarity, and how we are or we are not willing to take risks to help another person. And when we do, things happen. In the case of Richard, the male character in this trio, is a man who is so guarded that nothing can happen in his life. He's insured against everything except his memories, because he cannot be insured against his nightmares. But he's insured against everything else. He has a little life. He doesn't want anything to upset that life. He's vegan. He has four cats. Well, he's based on my brother, actually.
Oh.
And that's my brother, a person who has such a perfect life that nothing can happen. But then it does happen. Sometimes it does. And then...
Has your brother read this book?
Yeah, of course he doesn't recognize himself in the book.
He doesn't.
And when something happens in his life that tests him, we see the character, we see what kind of person he really is. And then he opens up. And by taking risks that he would have never thought he could take, everything happens in his life, good things.
Do you mind yet one more person telling you what happened in their mind as they were reading the book?
Of course, tell me.
Well, the two main characters, Richard and Lucia, reminded me of this country, because we're not a young country anymore. It feels that way, especially now. And there's this white man and a Chilean immigrant. They can't seem to connect. And an undocumented immigrant sort of brings things to a boil. And in the end, it's a hopeful story.
It's a story of redemption, yes.
Starts with a pot brownie and ends up with love. But man, there's hell in between. But I wondered whether you wanted us to be thinking about 2017 politics when we're reading this.
No, because the country was not as divided and polarized. There was not so much hatred in the air as now when I wrote the book. Only a year ago, in January of last year, when I started the book, Trump wasn't even a candidate. He became a candidate around May. And by the time I finished the book, he wasn't president even. So, but the issue of immigration and many other issues that are in the book were in the air. Trump didn't invent them. He just harvested the worst and created this movement that has divided the country so badly. In the book at the end, there's what I love, and I have this in many of my books, poetic justice, a sort of redemption that comes from sometimes bypassing law, the judiciary system, bypassing what is legal and just focusing on what is human, what comes from the heart, what really has to be done to help someone. And sometimes it's illegal. So be it.
That seems to be a theme with you sometimes. You wrote about Zorro,
yeah.
Right? Doesn't Zorro redeem outside the law?
Yeah. I don't trust the system most of the time. Remember that I lived through the dictatorship. In 24 hours, the legal system was demolished. And people had no rights of any kind. Anything could happen and no one would be punished for that. So I have seen how easily it can collapse. How easily we can violate the law. I recently was at the African American Museum in Washington, and there's a whole section about lynching. And I was so horrified at how that was almost legal. Almost legal. People were sending postcards to their friends with images of lynching. And more than 4,000 people were lynched in this country. And this was, did the law intervene? It didn't. So I don't trust the law much. But I trust the human heart. I think that if we have a chance to hear another person's story, to see another, look at another person in the eye, no matter what the color, from where they come, what language they speak, what faith they have, we can connect.
That is optimist, writer, philanthropist Isabel Allende, and her new book is called In the Midst of Winter, and she is talking tonight at Benaroya Hall, 7:30. It is sold out, but there will be standby tickets available. You can pick up a standby number at the box office starting at 6, and they're going to sell any available tickets a few minutes after the event starts. So we're tweeting out a link to that event right now. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. Back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Imagine you're in the hospital. You're being treated for a bad burn on your skin. The doctor has to change the bandages and treat the burn, but every time the pain is awful. Now imagine the doctor puts you in a virtual reality headset. Now you're focusing on this imaginary world and the pain fades. At the University of Washington, Dr. Sam Shar is experimenting with virtual reality to manage pain. Dr. Shar, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
Help me picture this. The doctor's treating me, hurting me. I'm wearing a VR, virtual reality headset. What am I seeing and hearing?
If you're in the hospital at Harborview, our system is such that you would be looking into a virtual environment. The one we often use is called Snow World. It's an icy Arctic canyon that the user floats through and can navigate through using either head controls with position sensors on the head-mounted display or with a mouse that they drive by hand. They see characters who are animated on the walls of this icy Arctic canyon. They hear music in the background. They are able to interact with the virtual reality environment by shooting snowballs at igloos on the canyon wall.
Not throwing snowballs at the characters, at the igloos.
At the igloos.
Okay.
That's right. They can shoot me at the characters if they want to, but it's meant to be a fun interactive experience.
Why snow?
It's snow. The snow was chosen specifically because burn patients often acquire their injuries in fire, hot environments, and the pain is often described as a burning or searing pain. So trying to recreate a mental image and a visual image of a cool, cold environment, we think, has benefit in terms of reducing their pain.
Oh, so it's not just distraction. It's you deliberately chose to put me in an opposite state of what I'm feeling?
Exactly right. That's exactly right. Again, trying to do everything we can to reduce one's sensation of pain, their experience of pain.
And how much is our pain eased typically? How effective is that?
So in the patients that we've studied in the burn unit, which we've been looking at now for almost 20 years, depending on what type of subjective measure of pain, subjective measure is often, how do you feel about your pain? Put it on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 is the worst and 0 is nothing.
Or the crying face versus the happy face.
Or the crying face, that's right. We like to use the numbers because they're better for statistics.
Okay, right.
But for kids, we do use the faces. The reduction in pain as measured in percentage is somewhere in the range of 20 to 40% in subjective pain or in terms of pain score. That's right.
20 to 40% pain reduction. And we know about the distraction part of it. My dentist has a TV screen up above me on the ceiling. Is virtual reality the ultimate distraction? Is it mostly about that? Is it like 50-50 distraction versus snow to a burn patient? What's going on?
So we choose distraction, and there is a spectrum of ways you can distract people. The most simple and low tech might be to ask someone to think about something else, and that's called mental imagery, where you don't use your dentist television or headphones. You just imagine yourself being in a different place to distract you from something that might be uncomfortable. The next step up might be something like your dentist, where you're looking at the television, you're wearing sunglasses, you're listening to some music in the background. But virtual reality takes it one step further in that we try to fully immerse the patient or the user in a virtual environment. They are wearing a headset so they cannot see the immediate medical world around them. They don't see their burn injury on their leg. They don't see the tools that are going to be used to clean their wound. They also are wearing headphones that they can't hear the sounds. They can't hear the conversation of the care providers talking about
their... Man, that sounds good.
And at the same time, we have them interact with the world so that there's a cognitive load. There's a demand on them to think about something other than what's going on with their wound care.
Do patients report that they even forget that they're being treated at a hospital? But for example, they're just doing this thing, and they're by the way, part of their experience is that, it's uncomfortable, but I'm in another world?
The goal is to have them be completely oblivious to what's going on. For the patients in the burn unit, the pain is pretty significant, and so it's hard to get them to that point. But we also do a lot of these studies in a pain laboratory at the university, and that's a common comment that we hear from our subjects when we put them into VR while we're doing some type of experimental pain is, well, when is that pain going to happen? And it's already happened.
See, that would make me think of, instead of a snowy scene where that feeling is maybe opposite from a burning pain, instead a situation that I could imagine myself in where I could, the pain I'm feeling could believably be part of the situation I'm in. So for example, it's a super hot day, or I don't know. You know what I'm saying? That it's incorporated, that it's a similar feeling that helps me forget that I'm even in a hospital, but that, yeah, I'm exercising, for example. It hurts, you know, but that's part of my virtual reality world. I'm not thinking about doctors and sharp instruments.
That's true. And one of our goals, not knowing exactly how virtual reality distracts patients or distracts their attention away from their pain, we do try to take their attention away from the pain by putting them into an environment that's either something that they're very used to or something that's very eye-catching or very immersive to them.
Did you say you don't really understand how this is operating?
True, we don't know. Virtual reality distraction has a number of different potential mechanisms. One is that we are refocusing a patient's attention away from the painful procedure that's happening and toward a completely different task. And that's why we use the cognitive load and we block out the sights and sounds of the immediate care environment. But there are some other potential reasons why it might work. You know that runners, for example, running marathons release endorphins. These are drugs that are very similar to opiates that can cause pain relief. It may be that virtual reality causes the release of endorphins.
Releases pain blockers. You're enjoying this game.
Pain blockers. Huh. That's right. And then a third one that might come up is just the pure act of doing something that's enjoyable changes a user's affect or their emotional state into a more positive state. And we all know that when people are, for example, depressed or feeling anxious, they experience a greater sense of pain when something uncomfortable happens to them. And the converse is probably true. If they're in a better state of mind, if they're happier, their emotional state is better, they will likely feel less pain. So we don't know which one of, for example, these three mechanisms might be involved.
Still so much to learn about.
Yeah.
This is Dr. Sam Shar in the Anesthesiology Department and Pain Management at the University of Washington. How much could this, because you're still giving patients pain medication, how much could VR, virtual reality, reduce the use of pain meds or even eliminate it?
Like many other non-pharmacologic pain relieving methods, things like hypnosis or biofeedback, there's probably a limit to the amount of pain that can be treated with virtual reality.
Yeah.
So one could hypothesize that for some, you know, relatively minor pain, virtual reality distraction or other non-pharmacologic techniques might be sufficient by themselves. In the burn center, for example, though, that's really bad pain.
Yeah.
And so the combination of the two is really requisite. And what we're doing by using VR is hopefully trying to reduce the amount of pain medication that we have to give them.
Well, yeah, what about reducing opioid use? Almost 700 people died an opioid-related death last year in our state. Could virtual reality reduce opioid use and addiction?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and it's one of the reasons that we're motivated to do this. There are recent data that suggests that a patient who takes even one day of an opioid prescription has a 6% chance of still taking opioids 1 year later. And that's a fairly high number. And if there's any way that we can reduce the number of people who need opioids in the hospital or reduce the dose that they get, we hope that that will consequently reduce the number of people who are using opioids on a long-term basis.
We just have a minute left, Doctor. How has your understanding of pain and managing pain changed because of your work?
You know, I think the biggest thing to me, trained as a biologist and as a scientist, is that pain was just a transmission line of electricity from the injured part of the body to the brain. And what I realize now is there is a lot of manipulation and modulation that happens in the brain itself that is unrelated to just the electrical phenomenon from the injured part of the body up to the brain. Your past experience of pain, your emotional state, those kinds of things can all affect your pain sensation in very dramatic ways.
So pain is a state of mind in a real sense.
Very much a state of mind. That's true.
Wow. Dr. Sam Shar, professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and Pain Management at the University of Washington. He's working on virtual reality. Is that something we could see? Is it happening right now in hospitals?
It's happening
out of the lab.
Happening right now in the hospital, and with the basic explosion in the last year or two of low-cost virtual reality hardware by many different vendors and software by many different companies, we see it on the horizon as being much more widely distributed.
Maybe to a procedure on you. Doctor, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you, Bill.
And thanks to tuning in today for The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Our show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. Come back tomorrow, and you're going to talk with Seattle's new mayor. Jenny Durkin joins us on KUOW tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.